I'm Joe Wood, and I believe.
October 31st, 1989, Troy, Montana. Sheila Young and her husband are watching their three children play in their home they share on an eight-acre farm. It's another peaceful, happy family evening when they notice a streak of fire shooting across the sky. The couple go outside to see if whatever it was has crashed on their land, but it's too dark to investigate. The next day, they see that tops of trees have been burnt, but no evidence of anything crashing. That night, the couple are awoken around 3 a.m. by bright lights shining through the entire house. Both feel intensely that they are being watched. The rest of that night is a blur to them. When Sheila regained consciousness, she noticed she has new scars. She remembers over several consecutive nights being hooked up to some sort of TV monitor. She recalls seeing it happen to hundreds of other humans at the same time. To this day, all five members of the Young family suffer from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
Welcome to Alien Nation, the ongoing series about extraterrestrials and UFOs, which asks the question, are we alone? I'll be talking to celebrities and everyday people who also believe and have their own incredible stories to share. We'll talk about well-documented cases, we'll examine the theories and the counter-theories, but mostly we'll just share our own personal experiences together. So get in touch with your own stories. I'll tell you how to do that at the end of the show. My guest today is a leading UFO researcher and author of several books, including Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, and Fact, Fiction and Flying Saucers. She is the director of MUFON's Experiencer Research Team. And her new book, Extraterrestrial Contact, What to Do When You've Been Abducted, is released in September. Welcome to the show, Kathleen Marden. I'd like to ask you about how you got interested in the subject. I suppose it was because of your auntie and uncle, Betty and Barney.
Yes, absolutely. There was no interest in that topic in my family. Yeah. I was 13 years old, and I had arrived home from school in the afternoon, and my mother was on the telephone with my aunt Betty, who was telling my mother about the close encounter she and my uncle had had the previous evening with an unconventional flying object.
How fascinating. I know about this story from just knowing about things like that. And that always fascinated me, this story. And I thought it was amazing. And they sort of, they had nightmares, didn't they? And eventually had to have hypnotism.
Betty was the one who had a series of five dreams. And that was it. Barney worked nights at that time, so he was not present when Betty had these dreams. She had them very early in the morning, just before she woke up. So they were sort of like hypnopompic dreams that occurred just before she woke up. And Barney thought they were nonsense when she told him about them. He had a different reaction. He was the one who had conscious recall of observing non-human entities staring down at him as he walked into the field alone. This is in upstate New Hampshire. The craft had swooped down over their vehicle. He had gotten out of the car to look up at it. And as he was doing this and stepped away from the car, the craft moved with him to an adjacent field, and he followed it into the field. This is when he saw these non-human entities. Betty did not see them because she was seated in the car. And Barney had the sense that they had a plan for him, and that plan was to capture him. So he became terrified and ran back to the car. This is what caused Barney the greatest degree of disturbance, of trauma, was this conscious memory. And also the knowledge that he and Betty had arrived home a couple of hours late and there was physical evidence that something had happened.
So what did they look like, did he say?
In the letter that he and Betty wrote to the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, they said that they were dressed in black, shiny uniforms. He was able to see them from the tops of their heads down to about their knees. And they were somehow not human. It frightened him so greatly that at that point he developed a mental block for exactly what they looked like. He knew that they moved in unison when all but one turned away from him and away from the window and walked to what seemed to be a panel encircling the front corridor along this craft. He was looking up at them through this row of windows, and one remained at the window staring down at him. When they moved away toward this, their arms went up in the air, and the craft started to tip toward him. Something started to drop down out of the bottom of the craft, and this is when he became terrified that they had a plan for him. And that plan was to capture him.
Oh, my goodness, how scary. What year was that?
1961.
Oh, 1961. Because I think this was the first sort of story that came out like this, wasn't it? I haven't seen anything else like Betty and Barney's story before that.
It was the first, and they never intended to release this story. Barney was very active in the civil rights movement and held important positions in the civil rights movement. He was also employed by the U.S. Post Office. Betty was a social worker for the state of New Hampshire, so they certainly did not want to be thought of as a couple of kooks. They were willing to talk to the Air Force, to the Navy, to scientists who were interested in what happened. But it, unfortunately for them, was released to the public as the result of a violation of confidentiality in 1965.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yes.
Who did that then?
Well, unfortunately, Betty had given information to a friend of hers, a woman from Massachusetts, and told this woman what was revealed under hypnosis.
Oh, so she went into the, so later on she was hypnotized to see what was, you know, what was troubling her.
Yes, she and Barney. Barney was the one who developed post-traumatic stress disorder and was referred to Dr. Benjamin Simon, who was a psychiatrist renowned for working with individuals who had physiological symptoms that were psychologically generated due to a traumatic experience. So they both underwent separate hypnosis and treatment with Dr. Simon for a period of 6 months. This started in January of 1964. And so he recorded this, that he saw them separately and reinstated amnesia at the end of each session. So they couldn't share what they had stated to him. He had two reasons for this. One was not to share it. The other one was that some of the emotional trauma released in these sessions was so explosive that if they remembered it all at once, it could increase their level of trauma.
Yes, I can imagine. My goodness, what a story. So you overheard your mother talking to your aunt about this.
Yes, and within a couple of days, my family and I drove to Betty's and Barney's house and saw some of the evidence and heard the story firsthand at that point.
And what sort of evidence was there?
Well, when they arrived home, Betty's good dress that had been in fine condition when she put it on the previous morning was torn in several places.
Oh my God. The lining
was torn from waist to hemline. The hem was torn down on that side of the dress. There was a tear in the zipper that went up the back of her dress, and a 2-inch tear in the stitching, and a 1-inch tear in the thick zipper fabric. None of this could be explained. She folded it and put it in her closet, and the next time she took it out, it was covered with a pink powdery substance that has been analyzed in 6 different laboratories. Also, Barney's best dress shoes were so deeply scraped, he had to buy new shoes. The binocular strap was broken. The watches they were wearing that night had stopped working and never ran again. And there were shiny spots on the trunk of their vehicle that hadn't been there the previous day. And when they took a compass and placed it over these spots, the needle would whirl. Whereas when they moved it away from these spots to other areas on the car, it would not.
How fascinating. My goodness, that's incredible. So after their hypnotism, how were they? Did they sort of get themselves back to normal life and understood what happened to them, or did they ever recover from that?
Well, they did recover somewhat. They went back to normal life, very, very active in the civil rights movement. Barney was appointed by the governor of the state of New Hampshire to serve on the U.S. Civil Rights Commission State Advisory Committee, very important position in the state. He was active in politics, as was Betty, working on political campaigns and also working with the civil rights movement. They also set up a program for the people of New Hampshire through the Office of Economic Opportunity. And Barney received an award for his work on that. So this was their major interest.
Yeah.
And it was fine. They were doing very well until this violation of confidentiality that took their story to the public.
So how did they deal with the press afterwards when it went public?
They were afraid they were going to lose their jobs. Fortunately, they did not. They stated that they were surprised that people actually believed them. There were others who, you know, obviously did not.
Yeah.
But they were surprised that it was received as well as it was. However, Barney stated that he would not believe it if somebody told him that story.
Oh,
and
really?
He was a confirmed skeptic. He kept attempting to convince himself that this was not real, even when he was watching it in the sky.
Isn't that amazing?
So this had an impact on Barney. He started to become troubled again by this questioning, by the fact that this was released. It placed great stress on him because he really wanted to do good work in his community, in his state, for his government. And this was interfering with that and interfering with his reputation.
Yeah, and I expect it wouldn't. Back in 1965, yes.
Yes, and he was very concerned about his public image, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
So it had a negative effect on Barney.
So meanwhile, as a young girl, you must have found that fascinating.
Yes, I was absolutely fascinated about it, wanted to learn more. Mm-hmm. I had the opportunity to meet all of the early investigators, the scientists who were involved in their case, some of the military people who were involved as well. And I found it simply fascinating. I was also involved in politics with Betty and Barney, and we were invited to Lyndon Johnson's presidential inauguration.
Oh,
and
how fantastic.
Yeah, so we were doing good things in the state and the community despite this kind of crazy story that was attached to my aunt and uncle. And I remained curious and fascinated by this for many, many years. I ended up going to college and studied to become a social worker. From there, I did graduate work in education and became a teacher and an education services coordinator. Yeah. But about in the year 1988 to 1990, I renewed my interest in their case. I decided that I wanted to investigate it myself, leaving no stone unturned, to evaluate it, to determine whether or not it was real. I took a skeptical approach. I rode along the entire route that Betty and Barney took on that night. Yeah. On all of the same roads that they were on, attempting to puncture this story. I also listened to all of the hypnosis tapes and transcribed them for comparative analysis, looking for any kind of discrepancy.
So what made you want to do that?
Well, it was so personal to me. That and I had seen a UFO in Betty's in the company of my aunt, my mother, my grandmother, my brother, and I and a family friend saw a UFO near my childhood home in Kingston, New Hampshire, when I was 18 years old in 1966. Ah. 2 months later, a craft was seen landing on my grandparents' farm, and I grew up across the street. So this increased my interest in learning more about all of this and determining exactly what was going on, what the government knew about this, and exactly what did happen to my aunt and uncle. And I have to say that I have continued my research from 1988 to the present day. It has been very fascinating to research all of this, to look at the government records, to visit physical archival collections, and I have written 5 books to date.
Yes, I saw that in your bio. Very impressive, actually. Before I ask you about that, what was your UFO? What did it look like? Was it a saucer shape, or because there's all different types?
Yes, it was very close to saucer shaped.
Yeah.
My aunt described it as kind of like a beehive. I don't know what she meant by that.
Oh.
I remember seeing what appeared to be kind of saucer shaped with a lighted row of windows. It came down over a lake. We were standing on that lake, and my Aunt Betty was flashing a flashlight at it to try to draw it in. It moved to another area of the lake. We followed it there. We're looking for it. My mother was looking in the opposite direction than the rest of us, and she saw two that were hovering low right over the ice, and one of them put out kind of a bluish beam that came in a measured way toward her, striking her. At that point, she screamed and yelled, and we all ran, got back into the car, and drove away quickly.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. It's quite the place then to have UFO sightings where you are, where you lived.
Yes, it was. But I think that perhaps this was the result of an experiment that my aunt had agreed to do with a team of scientists. They were giving her the words to say each night, and she was to go outside and repeat these words. The scientists were hoping that these entities who had taken Betty and Barney would be able to communicate with Betty and would listen to her request. And it was after she took part in this experiment that this began to happen. We're not aware of it ever happening before that.
How fascinating. What did she say? What did she have to say? Do you know?
Well, yes, I have some of the script, because they would ask Betty to talk about landing in certain places. On one, it was landing on Betty's parents, the Barrett farm in Kingston, New Hampshire. I'm not going to give you the address,
but
on the particular street address, and they would... she would go out and she would ask for this over and over again. And I think that she found that after she had done this for a period of 2 to 3 months, that then they would see something. And it wasn't just on the farm. The scientists asked for a craft to come in at various locations. They would go out with their team and look. And sometimes they would see craft and sometimes they would not.
That's amazing, isn't it, that the scientists were working with Betty to try and pull them in again.
Yes.
You see, me personally, I would absolutely love to meet aliens. but that's me. So, Kathleen, tell me about your most extraordinary case you've ever studied.
Well, I have to say that the Betty and Barney Hill case is the most extraordinary case, because it has the most evidence. Mm. Also, the abduction case of Travis Walton in the White Mountains of Arizona. And I'm sure you're familiar with that. He was a 22-year-old man returning home from work at night and working in the National Forest on a logging crew. And when he and all of the other members of the crew saw this, what they thought at first was a fire, as they approached it, they realized that it was not. It was a craft hovering just beside a tree. He got out of the truck and walked toward it. And that was his big mistake, because the beam hit him first, threw him back into the air. Something must have gone wrong, because I know, as a researcher who has spoken with thousands of people who believe they've had these experiences, that this is the beam that sort of absorbs them and they end up on the craft. So his was a very interesting story. You know, he passed a lie detector test, more than one. So did my Aunt Betty Hill. He had witnesses. The reporter who broke the story about Betty and Barney found at least a dozen witnesses to the craft that night. So very similar in their reports. They all ended up on a table in craft undergoing some kind of examination. With Travis, it seemed that they were trying to heal him because he had been injured when he was thrown backwards in the air. But there was more physical evidence in Betty's and Barney's clothing than in Travis's. But Travis had all of those crew members who took lie detector tests. They all came under suspicion of foul play. Really? So they had to clear themselves, and they passed the lie detector tests, saying that they had done nothing to Travis and that they had also been witnesses to this craft.
How many abductees would you say that you've met?
Met in person or spoken?
Yes, met or spoken to.
Well, I've spoken to well over 1,000 individuals.
Oh, my God.
I have met many of them in person because I speak at conferences.
Yes.
And I am also a quantum healing hypnosis practitioner. So they come to me seeking assistance and healing from the emotional trauma that some of them carry. Mm. So I have met face to face in the hundreds, I would say.
And you were colleagues with the great Stanton Friedman, weren't you, who just recently passed away?
Yes, Stanton and I worked together for many years. We
yes.
wrote three books together.
Yes.
And he was one of the scientists who was interested in my aunt and uncle's case, particularly Marjorie Fish's analysis and identification of a star map that Betty stated she saw on this craft.
Oh, didn't she draw it out?
Yes, under post-hypnotic suggestion.
Yes.
Dr. Benjamin Simon instructed Betty to sketch this map that she saw on the craft if she remembered it accurately and if it didn't bother her too much to do so.
Yes.
And over the next couple of weeks, she was able to sketch it, and it was published in the first book that was ever written on this case.
Yes.
And Marjorie Fish, who was a member of Mensa, meaning that she had a genius IQ and an amateur astronomer and a school teacher, saw this map in the first book. She was skeptical about this, but she thought that if this place really existed in our local galactic neighborhood, she would be able to find it. At first, she thought she would find many matches for Betty's map. In the end, she found only one, and that was after she had looked for many years. She would go to the university to take a look at their astronomical catalog. She couldn't take them home. There was no photocopy machines in that day and time, so she had to sit down and write down all of the distance data take this home. And she constructed 23 models of our local galactic neighborhood using monofilament line and beads of different sizes and shapes, representing all of the characteristics of these stars. And when she finally did get a match, it was because new distance data had been released in a catalog that was published in 1971. There were three stars that were not available to her before that with new distance data, and a couple more that she moved around with the new data she had. And finally, she did have a fairly accurate match for Betty's map.
That's incredible, isn't it?
It is incredible.
Yeah, that is.
There was
really
a lot of controversy.
I bet there was. You, Kathleen, have been a member of MUFON.
I am MUFON's Director Experiencer Research.
Yes.
I now have a team of 34 individuals. We're kind of a highly specialized part of MUFON. We have people, many people with advanced degrees, including a psychologist with a PhD, a psychiatrist, MD psychiatrist. We have a couple more. One is an academic researcher, PhD, and a psychotherapist with a master's, another psychotherapist with a master's. My assistant director is a retired orthopedic surgeon. So we have kind of a high-powered team who is taking a look at all of this. We did a social research project as well on 516 experiencers.
Yeah.
It ended in 2018 with some very interesting findings. Prior to that, I joined MUFON way back in 1991 because I wanted to study to become a field investigator. I wanted formal training in how to investigate all of this I thought that I needed it if I was going to do a really good job on the investigation of my aunt and uncle's case. So I was previously MUFON's director of field investigator training. And since 2011, I have been their director of experiencer research.
And don't you think these days it feels to me that people are so much more open-minded about the fact that we're not alone? Whereas 20 years ago, if I'd done this kind of a thing, people have said I was crazy. So I think people are becoming open-minded to it. I mean, it would be very sad if we weren't alone, and so there's got to be so many millions of civilizations out there. I'm convinced of that. And I think more people these days are.
I agree with you. I believe this is true. I believe that people are beginning to realize that we are not at the apex of achievement in our technological development, that there could be other civilizations out there who are much more technologically advanced than we are, that they have learned how to travel through space very quickly and without having their craft destroyed through a field that they've built around this craft, and that they have come here and they have met humans that they're very interested in.
Yes, I'm sure. I mean, after all, our planet must look very inviting, the blue planet. You know, I'm sure they would want to come and see what's going on here.
I agree. And I mean, if I were an astronaut and I had traveled to another planet that was like the beautiful planet we live on, I would certainly be interested in the flora and the fauna and who is the top species and their behavior and their technology.
Mm. But you must meet lots of people that are really skeptics and think it's rubbish. I can never understand why people think that we would even be alone on this planet, in this universe. But how do you deal with them?
Well, there are some skeptics, and certainly I have to look at what type of skeptic they are. There are some skeptics who simply believe that we are at the apex of development and no one could ever achieve more than we have at the present day and time. There are others who are frightened about all of this, and they're skeptical in order to protect themselves from this fear that they carry. For those people, I understand, and I would not want to push anything on anyone that would make them feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Then there are those who call themselves debunkers, or often referred to as debunkers, but these individuals build a hypothetical story around any credible case to dispel the public's interest in that case. I don't call them debunkers because they're not taking the bunk out of anything. They're putting the bunk in. Yeah. I call them disinformants. And Stanton Friedman and I have done a great deal of physical archival research on the correspondence files of these individuals who are so well known as debunkers. And we have written a book, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers.
Oh, that I must get that.
A great deal of insight into all of the major evidence cases in history and how this group of disinformants treated those cases, also government studies on UFOs and that sort of thing. It was a fascinating research project that we carried out over a number of years, and we're very proud of that book.
I will definitely be getting that. You have a new book coming out in September, don't you?
Yes, I do. This new book is called Extraterrestrial Contact: What to Do When You've Been Abducted. And this was the idea of myself and members of my team at the Mutual UFO Network, because so many people come to us confused about what is occurring. And this book is designed to help individuals to come to terms with what is actually occurring. It gives you the tools on how to investigate it. It talks about the social research studies that have been done on experiencers, how to make it end if you want it to end. It's loaded with information for experiencers, for people who are interested in that topic, and, you know, basically the general public as well.
And where can we get this book?
Well, it is going to be available in the United States on Amazon.
Oh,
you
great.
Can pre-order it now. So probably in the UK, you have your own Amazon where you
yes,
can order.
Yes, I will definitely be getting that. What else is coming up for you, Kathleen, in the future?
Well, I have several conferences that I'm going to be speaking at over the summer and early fall. So I'm very, very busy with that. I'll be in this week, in just a few days, I'll be out at AlienCon in Los Angeles.
Oh, cool.
To speak. Last year, we drew 10,000 people each day. So we're expecting very large crowds. From there, I'll be going to Roswell, New Mexico to speak.
Oh, fantastic.
Then on to the MUFON International Symposium. You can see all of this on my website.
All right. I would definitely check out your website. And will you be at the International UFO Conference?
Yes, I will. I absolutely will in September.
Yes, I'm thinking about going to that.
Oh, well, I would love to meet you there. I will be doing workshops for experiencers, and I will also be running support groups for experiencers.
Oh, that's so fantastic. I think I might come to that in September.
Well, that would be terrific. I hope that you do.
Kathleen Marden, thank you so much for giving me your time and talking to me. You're so interesting. I could actually talk to you for hours.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very, very much. That's our show for today. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please rate us on whatever platform you get your podcast from. It helps people like you find us. Today's show was produced by Mike Hansen for Pod People Productions. Associate producer Colette Cooper. Theme music by Mike Hansen and Jamie Allen. Special thanks to Nigel Heath and our narrator, Mike Hansen Sr. If you want to share your stories, we'd love to hear from you. Just email info@podpeopleproductions.co.uk, subject matter, Alien Nation. Beam me up next time. I'm Jo Wood, and I believe. Pod People.